Chapter 2. When Gus and Bertha's house finally came into view, I stopped. I'd been there 4 days already, but I still couldn't get over how that house hung off the side of the mountain like it did. The front of the house sat smack dab on the ground, with flowering shrubs nestled right up against it. But the back was on stilts stuck into the steep mountainside. On top of the stilts was a tiny porch with two rocking chairs and a window box full of flowers perched on the railing. On my first night in Colby, Gus had dragged a kitchen chair out there for me after supper. Bertha had asked me about a million questions, like what was my favorite subject in school, and did I have a lucky number? Did I want to go swimming at the Y sometime, and did I like boiled peanuts? But I just mumbled and shrugged till she finally stopped. I was too mad to talk. What was I doing there on that porch with these people I didn't even know? I felt like I'd been tossed out on the side of the road like a sack of unwanted kittens. So the three of us sat in silence, watching the sun sink behind the mountain and the lightning bugs twinkling off and on among the pine trees. I'd spent the next 3 days trying to convince Gus and Bertha that it was dumb for me to go to school since it was almost summer. But the next thing I knew, I was sitting on that bus full of hillbilly kids on my way to school. "Hey there," Bertha called from the front door, and I made my way across the yard. A fat orange cat darted out from behind the garden shed and trotted along beside me. Gus and Bertha had a whole passel of cats sleeping under the porch, sunning on the windowsills, swatting bees out in the garden. I went inside and dropped my backpack on Gus's tattered easy chair. The smell of warm cinnamon drifted through the kitchen door. "I made coffee cake," Bertha said. "I wonder why they call it coffee cake. Not a drop of coffee in it." She held the door open for the cat to come in. "Oh, I know. I bet 'cause you're supposed to drink coffee when you eat it. You think? Well, anyways, who cares, right?" It had been clear to me from day one that Bertha was a talker. Not like her sister, my mama, who went for days without saying a word. I'd been surprised when I saw how much they looked alike, though. Some same mousy brown hair, same long thin fingers, even the same crinkly lines along the sides of their mouths. I sat at the kitchen table and watched Bertha cut a thick slice of coffee cake and put it on a paper towel in front of me. Then she pulled her chair close to mine and said, "Tell me everything about your first day. Your teacher, the other kids, what your classes looked like, what you had for lunch, what you did at recess, every little thing." "Some girl ate a squirrel sandwich," I said. Bertha's eyebrows shot up. "A squirrel sandwich? Are you sure?" I licked my finger and pressed it on the paper towel to get coffee cake crumbs. I nodded, but I didn't look at her when I said it. "I'm sure." A small gray cat sat on the kitchen counter grooming himself. I wonder if that was the one Howard had given them. Bertha picked him up and kissed the top of his head. "Charlie don't want cat hair in her coffee cake, Walter." Then she gently put him down on the linoleum floor. His tail twitched as he watched a line of tiny ants marching from under the sink to the dark spot on something sticky by the stove. "And there's an up-down boy in my class," I said. Bertha cocked her head. "What in the name of sweet Bessie McGee is an up-down boy?" She snapped a brown leaf off a plant on the windowsill and tucked it into her pocket. "This boy named Howard who walks up and down like this." I walked like Howard around the kitchen table. "Howard Odom," Bertha said. "Bless his heart. Good as gold, that boy is. Don't bat an eye when kids poke fun at him, calling him names like Pogo." She shook her head. "I swear, kids can be so mean sometime." "Pogo? Yeah, you know, like a pogo stick." He ought to punch their lights out, I said. That's what I'd do. Bertha widened her eyes at me and then shook her head. Not that boy. He wouldn't hurt a fly. All them Odins are like that. Good-hearted. Kind of wild sometimes, those boys of his. But good-hearted. She brushed crumbs off the table and tossed them into the sink. Shoot, just last week, 3 of those boys were over here helping Gus replace them boards on the porch that got eat up with termites, and they wouldn't have 1 penny. He sent them home with a burlap bag full of turnips, and they were happy as clams. Turnips? Any kids who were happy about a bag of turnips must be weird, if you ask me. Bertha sat at the table beside me again. So what else? She said. Tell me something else about school. I shrugged. I wasn't going to tell her about that getting to know you paper dropped onto Miss Wilbur's desk like a hot potato, or about Howard being my backpack buddy. So I just said nothing. Nothing? Nope. Bertha slapped her hand on the kitchen table. I almost forgot, she said. I got you something. She motioned for me to follow her down the hall to the tiny spare room where I'd been sleeping. Ta-da! She flung her arms out and grinned. I followed her gaze to the narrow bed in the corner. Propped up against the wall were 2 pillows and pink pillowcases with Cinderella on them. I realized this morning that this room didn't look one bit like a little girl's room, Bertha said. So I went down to Big Lots and got these pillowcases. I was going to get the matching bedspread, but it was a double and not a twin. I might go back and get this fluffy pink rug they have if I can get Gus to help me move the bureau. And I know I need to get my canning jars out of here and that old TV don't even work anymore, but... She rambled on and on, but I didn't even listen. Cinderella pillowcases. She must think I'm 5 instead of almost 11. She sure didn't know much about kids. That afternoon, Jackie called from Raleigh. She told me how Carol Lee's cousin came to visit and gave her a cashmere sweater she didn't want anymore. And Carol Lee's daddy was teaching her how to drive since Scrappy never would. She said she was thinking about putting blue streaks in her hair and that some boy named Arlo was taking her to a NASCAR race down in Charlotte. She was so busy telling me about her happy life that she didn't even ask me what it was like living in Colby with hillbilly kids who eat squirrel. After we hung up, I went back to my room and laid on the Cinderella pillows and felt sorry for myself. How could Jackie be so happy? It seemed like she didn't care one little bit about me anymore. I bet Scrappy didn't care about me anymore either. I bet he was so busy playing basketball behind the tall fence at the county jail that he didn't even think about me up here on this mountain and a house full of cats with these people I don't even know. And I knew for sure my mama wasn't thinking about me as she shuffled around the house in her bathrobe, all red-eyed and stoop-shouldered. I was definitely going to have to go out on the porch tonight and wait for the first star to come out so I could make my wish again. Maybe 2 in a day would do the trick. That night, out on the back porch with Gus and Bertha, I saw the first star twinkling over the treetops. I closed my eyes and wished like crazy. Making a wish? Gus asked. I felt myself blush. No, Bertha nudged Gus. Tell her about the time you wished your uncle, Dean, would disappear, and then he did, she said. Gus flapped his hand at her. Ah, now, Bertha. She don't want to hear that boring old story. He rocked his chair, making the porch floor creak and groan. While Bertha talked to Blue Streak and hardly ever sat still, Gus was quiet and easygoing, with a calm, slow way about him. He wore a baseball cap all day and half the night. His scraggly brown hair poked out from under it every which way. The bill of his cap was dark brown with dirt and greasy fingerprints. "That there is Pegasus," he said, pointing to a cluster of stars hovering way up over the top of the mountains in the distance. "Gus should have been a scientist," Bertha said. "He can tell you everything you ever wanted to know about stars and air and plants and water and weather and all that stuff." Gus let out a little pfft. "He thinks I married him for his looks," Bertha winked at me. "But I married him for his brains," she said. Gus laughed. And then the most amazing thing happened. They both breached out at the exact same time and held hands. It was like somebody had said, "Okay, on the count of three, hold hands." I'd never in my whole life seen Scrappy and Mama hold hands. Shoot, most of the time they didn't even look at each other. I watched Gus and Bertha sitting there gazing at the night sky, the corners of their mouths turned up in contented smiles. Every now and then, Bertha looked dreamily over at Gus like he was a movie star and not some scraggly-haired man who worked in a mattress factory over in Cooperville. He stayed out there till it started to sprinkle again, a soft, cold rain that sent the cats at our feet darting inside. I went to bed that night with my head swirling. I thought about Scrappy snoring away in the county jail and Mama staring up at the ceiling of her dark bedroom. I thought about Jackie whispering gossip and painting her toenails with Carol Lee. I thought about Howard Odom with his up-down walk and his good-hearted family. And I thought about Gus and Bertha holding hands under the glow of Pegasus. And then I thought about my own pitiful self, laying there wondering if my wish would ever come true. The next day, I wore Jackie's old white majorette boots to school. I knew I'd made a mistake the minute I got on the bus. As I made my way down the aisle, some of the girls pointed at my boots, giggling and whispering. I felt my face burn, and I glared at them. Howard motioned for me to sit next to him, but I flopped down in the seat behind him. I spent the morning drawing on my arm with a blue marker and pretending to read. At recess, Howard tried and tried to get me to let him show me around the school. "I'm your backpack buddy, remember?" he said. I shook my head. "Forget it," I said. "I'm not really interested. Besides, I'm not going to be here much longer." "Why not?" I rolled my eyes. "I told you I'm going back to Raleigh." "But what if your mama don't get her feet on the ground?" he said. "Well, what the heck kind of question was that?" I stomped away from him and plopped down under the cafeteria window and glared at the kids playing soccer on the playground. Once or twice, I glanced over at Howard. He was drawing circles in the dirt with his foot and looked all mopey. When the bell rang, everybody scrambled to line up. A bunch of wild boys pushed and shoved their way in front of Howard, and he didn't even say anything. I headed toward the line. A girl from my class named Audrey Mitchell waltzed right up to me and said, "Nice boots." She smirked while her friends giggled behind her. I felt Scrappy's temper working its way from the tip of my toes to the top of my head, hot as fire. Then I said, "Thanks, they're good for kicking," and I kicked her skinny shin hard. The next few minutes were a blur of crying and hollering and tattling, and then I found myself sitting in front of Mr. Mason, the principal. While he lectured about my inappropriate behavior, I studied the inky little stars and hearts I had drawn on my arm that morning. Mr. Mason asked me if I knew that what I did was wrong, and would I like it if somebody did that to me, and a bunch of other questions I didn't even care about. I said yes, sir, and no, sir, but I kept my eyes on my inky arm and clunked the heels of those majorette boots against the legs of the chair. I shrugged when he said he was going to have to call Bertha and tell her what I'd done. Then I went back to my class and said I was sorry to Audrey Mitchell, even though I wasn't really. And that was how my second day of school in Colby went. That afternoon on the bus, Howard ignored my laser thoughts again and made a beeline right for me. He dropped into the seat next to me. "You should save me a seat, 'cause I think backpack buddies are supposed to sit together," he said. "That's against the rules," I said. "I'm pretty sure you can save a seat for a backpack buddy." I rolled my eyes and looked out the window. "Why'd you kick Audrey Mitchell?" Howard asked. I told him how she had said, "Nice boots," with a smirk on her face. He shook his head and said, "Dang, Charlie, why you gotta get so mad about that? That ain't nothing." I shot him a glance. Maybe it was nothing to him, but it was something to me. I almost told him about my fiery temper that I got from Scrappy, but I didn't. Instead, I told him how I got sent home from kindergarten the very first day for poking some boy with a pencil. "Eraser end or pointy end?" Howard asked. "Pointy." "Dang, Charlie," I shrugged. "I know, but I was mad." "About what?" "He stuck his thumb right through my sandwich," I said. Howard shook his head again, making his red hair flop down over his glasses. "Here's what you do from now on," he said. "Every time you feel yourself starting to get mad, say pineapple."
"Pineapple?"
"Yeah."
"Why?"
"That'll be like a code to remind yourself to simmer down. Mama taught my little brother Cotton to say rutabaga every time he gets the urge to draw on the wall."
"Does it work?"
"Sometimes." That sounded like the dumbest thing I'd ever heard, but I didn't say so. He sat in silence as the bus made its way up the narrow mountain road. Every once in a while, the view out the window changed from woods thick with pine trees and ferns and moss-covered rocks to a wide open view of the mountains stretching on forever in the distance. A smoky haze hovered over them, soft gray against the deep blue of the mountains. "That's why they're called the Blue Ridge Mountains," Gus had told me in the first day I got to Colby. "'Cause they're blue." Then he had gone on to explain how the color was because of something the pine trees released into the air. I didn't know what the heck he was talking about, but I had noticed like I did. When the bus got to Howard's house, he grabbed his backpack and said, "Remember, pineapple." I watched him and his brother go up the rickety steps of the front porch and disappear inside the house, letting the screen door slam with a bang behind them. Next to the front door was a ratty-looking couch covered with bedspreads. Wilted yellow plants and dried-up flowers planted in coffee cans lined the edges of the porch. Maybe the Odoms' heart were so good that they didn't care that they lived in such a sad-looking house. The bus chugged and groaned up the winding road. I was thinking about what I was going to say to Bertha about my kicking incident when a commotion outside the window caught my eye. Two dogs were fighting in a dirt driveway beside a cluster of trailers. One was small and black, and the other one was brown and black and skinny as all get out. A little girl was screaming and carrying on while an old man turned on a garden hose and aimed a hard spray of water at the skinny dog. "Get out of here," he hollered. A woman ran out of one of the trailers and tried to grab the black dog while the skinny dog snapped and growled and then suddenly just took off running. He ran along the edge of the road beside the bus for a minute or two, his long ears flapping in the breeze. I pressed my face against the window and watched him lope along the side of the road and then turn and disappear into the woods. When I got off at Gus and Bertha's a few minutes later, I looked down at those majorette boots. Jackie had always looked so pretty in them, but I looked dumb. Those girls were right to laugh at me. That familiar mad feeling was settling over me like a blanket.
But this time I was feeling mad at myself for being a loser that nobody wanted. I stomped my foot and then I kicked at gravel, sending it tumbling into the rhododendron bushes along the side of the driveway. Then I whispered, "Pineapple," before heading up to Gus and Bertha's.